Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the increasing likelihood that President Trump will fire Special Counsel Robert Mueller, possibly as early as Friday, in a desperate attempt to shut down the investigation into Trump's ties to Russia. As congressional Republicans and Fox News ramp up inflated rhetoric and invented charges to discredit Mueller, we are joined by Joe McLean, a veteran political strategist, to discuss his article at The Guardian, What is the Republican Playbook for the Mueller Investigation? And whether in joining Trump's cover-up, the Republicans will succeed in the short term to avoid the damage of the public finding out their leader could be a traitor, or will they be punished in the long term when the truth eventually comes out? Then we'll look into what outraged citizens can do to reverse last Thursday's FCC vote to overturn net neutrality, which effectively ended the free internet, thus enabling oligopolies that provide internet access to begin discriminating based upon who can afford to pay for content as they lower the quality of service for those who can't. Matt Stoller, who was recently fired from the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute for his criticism of tech monopolies, joins us. We will look into how the cablization of the open internet will help monopolies consolidate their power, and with 80% of registered voters opposing the decision, we will also discuss whether such unpopular legislation could backfire on Republicans at the polls and provide Democrats with a counter message around antitrust and closing the income gap to expose Trump's corrupt and phony populism and recapture authentic economic populism. Then finally, we'll speak with Anthea Butler, a professor and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania, whose latest book is From Palin to Trump, Evangelicals, Politics, and Race. She joins us to discuss the role of African-American women in the victory against Roy Moore in Alabama and the need for a sustained movement of the religious left, women and the 65% of Americans opposed to the president, to get active and relentlessly demand Trump's removal from office. And joining us now is Joe McLean, who is a senior partner of the public affairs firm McLean Clark LLC and a veteran political and public affairs strategist who was part of the founding leadership team of Barack Obama's successful U.S. Senate race and managed Governor Doug Wilder's historic election in Virginia. He served as a legislative assistant to Congressman Ed Jones in the Tennessee delegation and was a campaign finance analyst with the clerk of the U.S. House of Representatives. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joe McLean.
Thanks, Ian. I'm glad to be with you. You read my resume. It sounds like I can't hold a job.
Well, let's hope that we find out that the president can't hold a job, because that's, if the rumors are true that he could fire Mueller as early as Friday, and there's no question that Trump is laying the groundwork and he's working in concert with Fox News and Rupert Murdoch. Just the other day in the White House, he said, you know, the people are angry. The people are angry. We've got to do something about this, the FBI and the special counsel and the Justice Department. Well, the people are angry because Fox News is making them angry. So you can see the pattern here, you know, of Fox generating this phony scandal over Mueller and questioning this incredibly, you know, highly decorated war veteran, lifelong Republican. Nobody's ever said a bad word about him until lately. And then now you've got Senator Cornyn weighing in against him. So it seems to me that this is an orchestrated campaign.
It looks that way. It's a little hard to tell who's driving the bus, whether it's Trump or Fox News. And I agree with that. But it does appear that members of Congress are taking their cue either from the White House or from what they see on Fox with Hannity and whatnot. And it appears that they are laying the groundwork for the White House to be able to say, well, Congress demands that we fire Mueller. Congress is going to look into the scandal of the special prosecutor. It looks like to me that's what they're setting up to do. Although today they have repeatedly denied that they have any intention of doing so. You know, please don't throw me in that briar patch. My question is, I don't understand why. It seems so counterintuitive to me. It makes no sense over the long term why the Republican leadership in Congress would allow themselves to be dragged into this morass?
Well, the only explanation I can come up with is that Trump has decided that he simply cannot afford this investigation to continue into his ties to Russia, simply because he is. There's no other explanation for his behavior with Putin, who he just talked to the other day on the phone, and even Putin is praising Trump for his handling of the stock market, which is pretty extraordinary in itself. The possibility that the president of the United States is a traitor is an inescapable one, because his explanation in the long piece in the recent long piece in the Washington Post makes it clear that even the CIA briefers now with the presidential daily briefing cannot even mention Russia. I mean, if Russia invaded Ukraine, they couldn't even tell Trump, because he gets so mad at any mention of Russia, because they say, well, he feels that any mention of Russia questions his legitimacy as president. Well, if that were the case from day one, which it has been, then right out of the gate when Trump was elected, the first thing he would have done, if he's not a guilty person, he would have said, I demand an inquiry into this Russian investigation because I don't want a cloud hanging over my legitimacy. Isn't that logical?
It is logical, and it's hard to say whether this is a manifestation of Trump's myopic narcissism, or whether it indicates that he is indeed guilty of some collusion with the Russians. Every move he's made, every statement he's made, makes him look guilty, whether he is or not. He has misplayed. If he's innocent, he has misplayed this all the way down the line in the court of public opinion, and they continue to do so. I mean, you saw today where the transition lawyers, the lawyers for the transition, Trump transition, sent a letter to Congress maintaining that emails that were obtained by the special prosecutor, special counsel from GSA having to do with the transition were illegally obtained. Well, that's a farce on its face, and they know it, because if they had a legal case, they would have filed it in court with a judge. Instead, they sent it to Congress. So what they're doing is they're playing to public opinion, trying to muddy the waters, and it just doesn't make sense to me. The sooner Republicans clear this up, the better off they are in 2018 and 2020. It just seems to me that this is almost a suicidal jump, like lemmings off a cliff following Trump. If he's innocent, they're better off getting it cleared up. If he's guilty, they're certainly better getting it cleared up quickly, looking like statesmen. But Ian, the problem for Republicans in Congress is that they are the leftovers elected by a different Republican Party. The Republican base now is the party of Hannity and Fox News and Roy Moore and Donald Trump.
And Steve Bannon.
I'm sorry?
And Steve Bannon.
And Steve Bannon, absolutely. They're no longer the party of the giants of the Senate. They're no longer the party of McCain and McConnell and, you know, the reasonable, what we now call the Republican establishment. But they're no longer the establishment. You know, they're the rump end of a Republican Party that has moved significantly away from them. And the only thing I can figure is, you know, they must be afraid that their base is going to rear up and bite them if they don't stick with Trump. Although you would think, after Alabama, that fear would have been allayed.
And again, I'm speaking with Joe McLean, who's a senior partner of the public affairs firm McLean Clark LLC and a veteran political and public affairs strategist who was part of the founding leadership team of Barack Obama's successful U.S. Senate race and managed Governor Doug Wilder's historic election in Virginia. He served as a legislative assistant to Congressman Ed Jones in the Tennessee delegation and was a campaign finance analyst with the clerk of the U.S. House of Representatives. And he has an article at The Guardian, What is the Republican Playbook for the Mueller Investigation? Well, again, you get back to the only answer to my mind that makes any sense is that the Republicans are basically going along with this notion of damage control, that it's better not to have Mueller expose Trump's ties to Russia, because that would damage them all. So the longer they can delay that, the better. I mean, I don't think that would work, would it? I mean, if let's go through the steps then. What happens if they fire Mueller? I mean, and they obviously have to fire Rod Rosenstein. They've obviously going to probably during the week the House Intelligence Committee is going to collapse, which is another precursor. I mean, you can see the way this thing is lining up, can't you?
Well, absolutely. And those of us who are old enough to have lived through Watergate remember what happens when the president goes through and starts firing the Justice Department. It's in the long run, it won't work. It might delay the investigation some. But remember, we have two indictments and two guilty pleas already on the table. This investigation is not going away, and they can't kill it. And if you look at the polling on this, it runs into the high 70s. Over 70% of the American people have faith in Mueller, and they want to see the investigation go forward. So this is a dead end. I mean, it won't work. In fact, it will backfire, just like it did on Nixon. You'd think they would learn that. And let me just say this, Ian. I'm a Democrat, and I'm not a Trump supporter. That's true. But I'm also an American who believes in the two-party system. And my real concern here is that the Republicans are going to damage their own party so much that they will cease to function. And that's not good for the country. That's not good for America. You need to have two sides to every discussion. You need to engage in a meaningful debate over the issues that are important to the future of our country. And they're about to destroy themselves in such a way that they're not going to be meaningful participants, I fear. And I don't understand why. In the same way, I don't understand why they tried so hard to repeal Obamacare when the public support for that ran in the low 20s. I don't understand why they've now passed this god-awful tax bill in the face of public support that runs in the mid-20s. You know, over 50% of the American people think this is a bad tax bill. 70% of the American people think that Mueller's doing a good job and ought to go forward. They are captive to a radical Republican base that now makes up, you know, somewhere around in the high 20s up to 30% of the American people.
But Joe, are they also captive of the donor class because they're doing the bidding of the donor class? That's the only way to explain this dreadful so-called tax reform bill.
I don't think there's any question about that, Ian. I think that's absolutely true. I think they've heard from their donors. And look, without going on a political polemic here, thanks to the Supreme Court and the repeated decisions that have made soft money so much more an important player in American politics, this is almost a foregone conclusion. The power of plutocratic money in American politics is almost a foregone conclusion. It is now legal for Daddy Warbucks to walk into, you know, Congressman Foghorn Leghorn's office and say, "Congressman, if you support this bill, I will spend $1 million out of my corporate coffers to get you reelected. And if you oppose this bill, I'll spend $1 million out of my corporate money to get you defeated." It's legal. Absolutely legal for a corporate CEO or a lobbyist to do that.
Well, but Joe, it's worse than that. At least I'm not sure because they've kept the details of this tax bill secret. But one of the provisions in this tax bill is to allow Daddy Warbucks to deduct the money that he uses in politics to buy politicians or to punish them, to deduct it.
It's insane, isn't it?
Well, that to me is a victory for the plutocracy.
Absolutely. And that's the bad news. The good news is that there's almost no damage domestically that Trump and the Republican Party can do that we can't undo in the course of 4 or 5 years if the Democrats can take back the House and perhaps the Senate, maybe not this year, but next year. There's no damage that they can do that we can't undo domestically. What concerns me more than any of this is the damage that's being done internationally to our alliances, to our relationships, trade relationships, to the balance of power, particularly in the Pacific. You know, those things are hard to reverse. And on top of that, as I wrote in my article today, you see the Republican Party doing its very best to self-immolate. Makes no sense to me.
Well, but you know, obviously the Chinese have been gifted by Trump from day one. Getting out of TPP is just a huge gift to China. And as he weakens America, I think, you know, not that everything is a zero-sum game, but it does seem that China is the beneficiary of the Trump's weakening of America, and so is Putin. But so if you're a European, you must be feeling very insecure if you're trapped between Putin to the east, who's using hyper-nationalism to disguise the fact that he's a kleptocrat and stealing the country blind, and could use outside adventures to maintain his power, just as Trump could use, a little war with Iran, for example, to distract people if he goes ahead and fires Mueller. The Europeans are kind of caught between Putin on the one side and the Americans, who normally had their back, led by a guy who, you know, could be compromised or even owned by Putin.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you bring up an interesting point that has not really been widely discussed. The reason why Donald Trump Jr. and Manafort took the meeting with the Russian lawyer and all those folks wasn't to discuss adoptions. It was to discuss the sanctions, because the kleptocrats in Moscow are hiding money, billions of dollars, in international banks, and it requires the United States banking system to make that possible. Now, I'm not a banker. I don't understand all the details, but I've read about it and been told that it's virtually impossible to hide money in offshore accounts, anonymous accounts, without at least the cooperation of the American banking system and the European banking system. And so it becomes very difficult for Putin to reward his minions and protect his capital, his ill-gotten gains, while these sanctions are in place, which is why they're so desperate to have them lifted.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Joe McLean, when you say that you don't think he could get away with a Trump, he's different. I mean, he's trained by Roy Cohn. He's ruthless, and if he's a trapped animal, and if he's a guilty guy, which I think he is, then he's capable of doing thuggish things which most normal politicians wouldn't embrace. Is it possible that he could fire Mueller, fire Rosenstein? He's already got Devin Nunes and Trey Gowdy going to shut down the House Intelligence Committee. That's already dysfunctional at any rate. We know that several people inside the Justice Department have been reassigned to dead-end jobs. So there could he do a purge of the DOJ and a purge of the FBI and a purge of the CIA? I mean, if they put in this guy Tom Cotton, this senator, and if they move Pompeo, Secretary of State, Cotton could absolutely destroy the CIA single-handedly. So could they get away with it? Could Trump get away with a coup, in effect, and a purge of the very people in the government who are trying to hold him to account?
In the short run, he might for a while. Now, I will say this. Trey Gowdy's in some trouble. It's now been disclosed that the Congress paid out a settlement for some kind of abuse. Frankly, it's not clear whether it was sexual harassment or not, but Gowdy's in some trouble. because of his past behavior. So yes, I mean, it's certainly possible that with Trump's little minion, Jefferson Beauregard Sessions, as Attorney General, one of my favorite caricatures in American politics, he could certainly get away with decimating the Justice Department for a period of time. But ultimately, Ian, in the court of public opinion, that is a disastrous play. He cannot long survive, and Republicans cannot long survive in office if they let him get away with that.
So if the Republican Party then cracks up, and you say it's already has, it's already happened, that it's been captured by the kind of Tea Party nativist wing, what happens to these traditional Republicans? Will they? Could you form a new centrist party, or would they? Could they migrate to the Democratic Party? I mean, you know, economic populism, which I think is the best thing going for the Democrats now to oppose what's happened, is not necessarily centrist. It's more to the left, isn't it?
Well, you have three Republican parties. You have Wall Street and the robber barons, the CEOs. You have the Main Street sort of moderate people who are socially sort of ambivalent and physically conservative. And then you have the Bannon wing, the misogynistic, white supremacist, nationalist rabble-rousers who've sort of taken over the Republican Party, at least in some places, in some states. So you really have three. So the question is, where do they go? And that is the open question, and I don't know. And lots of us, and I'm sure you have dedicated a lot of thought to that, and I don't think we know which way this cat's going to jump. But it's clear that there is an open civil war in the Republican Party, and it's three-sided. But it needs to be resolved, because we need to go back to regular order in American politics. And traditionally, that has meant two strong, functioning parties to encourage a robust debate. And we just don't have that now. I mean, look, they just jammed this tax bill through with virtually no debate, no hearings, right. No nothing. In fact, the thing wasn't even available to be read until Friday.
Well, Joe McClain,
people didn't know what was in it until Friday, right. And they're going to vote on it Monday.
Well, Joe McClain, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, it's my extreme pleasure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Joe McClain, who's a senior partner in the public affairs firm McClain Clark LLC, a veteran political and public affairs strategist. He was part of the founding leadership team of Barack Obama's successful U.S. Senate race. He managed Governor Doug Wilder's historic election in Virginia, served as legislative assistant to Congressman Ed Jones, and he has an article at The Guardian, What is the Republican playbook for the Mueller investigation? We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether the Democrats can find a message around antitrust and closing the income gap to expose Trump's corrupt and phony populism and recapture authentic economic populism. You can't hide. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com And joining us now is Matt Stoller, who until recently was a fellow at the Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation, where he researched the history of the relationship between concentrated financial power and the Democratic Party in the 20th century. Previously, he spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. In addition to his work on the Hill, he has produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell Brand. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matt Stoller.
Thanks for having me.
And I think a lot of our listeners, Matt, are in despair over what happened last week with Ajit Pai ending net neutrality. The battle, of course, is not over. He rubbed salt in the wound through a mocking video of those that support net neutrality. And it does seem like this is consistent with most of the people that Donald Trump has brought into the government. Their job is to destroy the very government departments and the mission of the very government departments that they're put in charge of. So do you have any words of optimism for us here today?
Yeah. Look, I mean, I'm very optimistic. I have sort of a weird position, but, you know, I looked at the 8 years of the Obama administration as a lot of missed opportunities and tremendous sort of weaknesses. And so it's not a surprise when you put forward a bunch of very mild policies that within a year, a different administration comes in and undoes them and makes the situation a lot worse. And I think that the reason for optimism is that anything that can be done by people can be undone by people. And the Democratic Party, which is the opposition party, I think has learned to stop engaging in sort of mild sort of regulatory overlays on concentrated capital. And that's what net neutrality was. And I think next time Democrats gain power, they're just going to say, you know what, we can't work with concentrated power like telecoms. No matter what we do, they're going to operate in bad faith. We need to just break their power. And I think that's what's coming. There's a very aggressive attempt to break the power of telecom barons and tech barons.
So who's the new Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's sort of an interesting competition to see. You know, you've seen people like Bernie talk about too big to fail banks, but you've seen Elizabeth Warren. She's talked about concentrated power in the context of Google. But then you've also seen, oddly enough, people like Mark Warner, who is a more conservative Democrat, talking about the power of Facebook. You've seen John Kennedy, who's actually a Republican senator from Louisiana, talk about the power of Google and Facebook. And then with net neutrality, it's pretty much across the Democratic Party. So, you know, there's Seth Moulton has mentioned some things. Keith Ellison has mentioned some things. David Cicilline, all three are young congressmen. Beto O'Rourke is running for Senate in Texas and is a congressman. He started talking about monopoly questions. So what you're seeing is actually an intellectual turnover within the Democratic Party and also around the world. And that's the thoughts precede actions, ideas precede actions. And we are in a very healthy stage of getting rid of the bad ideas that were dominating policy for decades.
Well, do you think that given that Teddy Roosevelt, of course, was a Republican reformer, he was put on the ticket to balance McKinley, who was shortly thereafter he was elected shot, but in a way, a kind of accidental president. Is there any, you mentioned the Senator Kennedy from Louisiana, who grilled one of the dreadful people that Trump is putting up for the federal courts, and he certainly equipped himself well there. Is there a possibility? I mean, my sense is that the Republican Party is going to split, and I think the fissures will be exploded, because my sense is that very soon Trump is going to fire Mueller and try and shut down the investigation into his ties with Russia. And I think it's going to be an explosive political event. Is there a possibility of some kind of new alliance between moderate Democrats and moderate Republicans?
You know, I don't really follow the Mueller stuff. I can only follow so many things, and I'm writing a book right now that has to do with history. But I will say this. No, I don't think that there is a possibility of you know, Republicans are Republicans. They care about what they care about. And what they want is they have a political economy vision that they want to implement. There could be splits. I think there are splits. I'm seeing that on Monopoly. In terms of Mueller or any of the sort of partisan stuff, generally speaking, you know, they will just line up behind their guy, just like Democrats line up behind their guy.
Mm. Well, I was just thinking that, you know, that the party has largely been taken over by the Bannon, Roy Moore types, and I wondered if the traditional Republicans.
I don't actually think that's true. If you look at the guy behind Trump, whose vice president is Mike Pence, right? And he's a Koch brothers guy. Mm. And then if you look at a lot of the policy, what you really see is, except on trade, where I think the Trump administration is doing some good things, and they've got a USTR guy, his name's Robert Lighthizer, who's doing a pretty good job. Really, it's just sort of down the line Koch brother policy implementation. And the Republicans tend to be pretty agreed on that. And in terms of the Bannon wing, you know, you see a little bit of anti-monopoly stuff. There's a Missouri attorney general, and then you see the Trump attorney general doing some things. But I don't think that that's coming. Like, I don't know. I think there could be splits, but I don't necessarily see the split the way that most people see it.
And again,
and it's not going to split over something like Mueller. They'll just go along with it.
Sure. So let's talk about the consequences of the repeal of net neutrality last week. It would seem to me that the sort of older, I mean, what just not to harp on the Trump administration too much, but, you know, with trying to revive coal, and you mentioned the Koch brothers who are getting all of the windfalls from this administration and this Republican Congress, they are old industries, extractive industries. Coal is a complete relic. There's a feeling that this government is empowering these dinosaur industries, and the cable monopolies are the most disgusting dinosaurs. They keep charging you more for less. I don't think there's anybody in this country that is happy with their cable service, and now we're going to have the cableization of the internet with these same monopolies like Verizon, AT&T, and Comcast, and they're going to shake down Google and Facebook, who are making all the money, right? They get 90% of all advertising revenues, and these guys want a piece of it. So is this going to be a battle between the telecoms and Facebook and Google?
I think that's one way to understand it. I think what you're going to see, so typically when you remove, when you make, so net neutrality is basically just a law that makes the internet access and the internet platform an open market for anyone to compete. So getting rid of net neutrality means that now you have to get permission from a telecom provider to actually operate on top of the internet. So what you're likely going to see is the people who are best situated to negotiate with these new telecom kings are the tech kings, the tech monopolists. And so you're going to see a lot more either vertical mergers, so, you know, Amazon buying a telecom or something like that, or you're going to see collusive arrangements, so telecoms and tech companies working together to exclude other competitors. So this is actually going to be good for the tech monopolists like Google, Facebook, and Amazon. They like this. They're perfectly happy to pay the telecoms to make sure that there's no one who can compete with them in other areas. So what we're going to see is a sort of merger between the tech and the telecom monopolists to collude against potential future competitors and to collude against democracy itself.
That's
like a bummer, but
I know. I'm just trying to get my head around it. But in essence, then, the role that they've been playing so far in pretending to protect net neutrality, you think Google and Facebook, I can't imagine Netflix and Amazon going along with it. I mean, are they all on board?
Well, they don't care. I mean, Netflix is perfectly happy to raise barriers to entry against future potential video competitors. Disney is buying, 21st Century Fox.
Right.
AT&T is buying Time Warner. They're all trying to get bigger so that they can participate in this new world of giant scale. And the people who lose are any potential competitors and the public itself. Now, so that's the bad news, and that's some substantial bad news. Don't get me wrong. But it's also the case that we've been dominated by monopolies for a really long time now in every area, from hospitals to glasses to search engines to software, et cetera, et cetera. And the reason is because we've tolerated it as a people. And that's ended. I think you've seen massive, massive anger about this net neutrality decision. And the idea that you would have 5, 10 million people speaking out on a regulatory decision, if you had thought about that 15, 20 years ago, it would have seemed absurd. But that kind of anger and frustration and the unification of the Democratic Party around this industrial organizing principle is a new kind of politics. And it's a very promising kind of politics. And we do live in a democracy. And I know people don't really believe in democracy anymore, but we do live in one. And this will have really significant consequences and positive consequences for the way we do policy when the Democrats take the majority in 2019 and when they take the presidency in 2021. So I'm very optimistic. We're going to fix this, and it's going to be a much better world when we do.
So this is then a pendulum swing? Is this Newton's law? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, it's overreach. I mean, when you say we're a democracy, democracies have to be nurtured and sustained. I think we're under attack both at home and abroad with creeping autocracy. You know, the bad guys seem to be winning around the world, whether it's Xi in China, Putin, Erdogan, Duterte. And, of course, Trump is a buddy-buddy with the bad guys. And he's shown rather flagrant autocratic tendencies here at home. So this is not a battle that's going to be won by the swing of the pendulum. People are going to have to put skin in the game, aren't they?
Look, I mean, the Koch brothers are autocrats, okay? They want to finance, get rid of democracy. That's their goal. They were worth $25 billion in 2008. In 2016, at the end of the Obama administration, they were worth $100 billion. So you can say that Trump is this, you know, sort of new autocratic force, but autocracy actually grew under the Democrats. It's growing under Trudeau in Canada. It's growing under Macron in France. The model of autocracy, as FDR said this in 1938, weak democracies invite dictatorships. The Democrats have been about having weak democracies, and that has invited dictatorship. The right way to respond to rising autocracy is to actually govern well and to have a broad distribution of property. This has been well known for hundreds of years. So that's what Democrats are going to get back to. They realize they failed. They realize that for the last 8 years, and probably you can go back to Clinton, you can go back to even to Carter, when you don't distribute property relatively evenly, this is what you get. So we're going to, next time we take power, we're going to actually do this. And the thing is that if you don't break the power of these oligarchs, when they come back into power, they will simply finance a new autocrat. Only the new autocrat won't be like Trump. He'll actually be smart and disciplined instead of stupid and disorganized. So it's a scary thing to be confronted with autocracy. But the reality is we were confronted with autocracy in 2012 and 2010 and 2014. We just didn't want to admit it. Now the stakes are real in our face. We get it, and we know what we have to do to fix it. The question is, do people have the willpower to actually do it? Are they going to demand that from the Democratic Party? Will the Democratic Party be the party of the people? Will the people take it back? And will the people have the confidence in themselves to demand this of their elected officials?
Well, I suppose you can take heart from the polls that indicate the total rejection of this outrageous so-called tax reform that just is about to be signed by the president. It's so clearly a gift to the donors. At the same time, they're trying to con the voters. But the majority of the public is not buying it. I think it's, 80% against or something? So
yeah, the people know this is a scam. They know it's a scam. I mean, the Republicans are going to lose, and they're going to lose big. But this isn't necessarily a good thing. We've had wave election in 2006, 8, 10, 14, 16, and now likely 18. People want change. They want a democracy. They want a government that's going to address the opioid kings that are killing tens of thousands of Americans. They want a government that is going to crack down on the scams and the corruption they see all around them. And the first government to do that is going to govern for 60 years. And Obama had that chance, and he didn't. Trump has that chance, and he's not doing it. And so the only question is, you know, the Democrats are going to win. But the question is, what kind of Democrats are going to win?
Well, you're more or less indicating, without putting words in your mouth, Matt Stoller, that we need a Bernie Sanders. But Bernie's he's in his late 70s, right? Or he will be.
I mean, I'm not recommending any particular candidate. What I'm saying is that what you need is somebody, and actually Clinton had an anti-concentration policy in 2016. So this is a question of whether you're going to look at the people that are financing Trump, that are behind, you know, the Wall Street titans, the Silicon Valley titans, the, you know, Comcast financed the Democratic National Convention in 2016, right? Like, those are the people that are the problems, right? Are we going to, then when the Democrats take power next time, are they really going to govern to break the power of the autocrats in the commercial sphere, this concentrated capital that are strangling markets, that are strangling communities, that are strangling citizens, and that are strangling our politics? That's the question. Not kind of, is Trump a good guy or a bad guy, or should he be impeached or whatever? Mm-hmm. It's about us. It's about whether we have the confidence to govern. Because if we don't have the confidence to govern, then the monopolists are going to govern. And we have not had the confidence to govern for a really long time. But it is time for the party of the people and for the people themselves to say, you know what, we can use common sense and we can distrust these idiot economists who tell us that everything is great.
So the focus then is an antitrust focus. Is leadership aside, obviously, the people have to lead here as well. You made it clear, and I think it is absolutely the case, that the anger out there is palpable. The people get it.
Let me tell you a quick story to make this clear. Okay, so it's a guy named John Leibowitz, who was the Federal Trade Commission chairman under Obama, who allowed Google off the hook despite finding evidence of anti-competitive behavior. He wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal last week praising Ajit Pai and saying Democrats and Republicans can all agree that this is a reasonable thing to do to get rid of net neutrality. And he works both for tech companies and he works for Comcast. And this is the type of slime that exists in the legal world. And he's a Democrat. And he was a strong Obama administration official. And the Obama administration was full of these people. So John Leibowitz is hoping that the Democrats win in 2019 and 2021, and the Democratic voters are angry, and then he'll slither out of his little cave and slip into these important positions and govern. And he has done this in all sorts of areas to help hospital monopolists. He's done it to help cable companies violate privacy norms. He's done it against net neutrality. Leibowitz is the problem. These people are the problem. There is a whole nexus of people who live in D.C. who don't care about elections, and they come out of hiding after elections and they slip into these government positions and they ruin everything. And the whole point of what I'm saying is that this is the actual political problem we have, the John Leibowitzes of the world who then help Ajit Pai get rid of net neutrality. All of these economists and all of these sort of fake experts that come in and explain to us why our common sense doesn't make sense. And that's what we have to get rid of. And that's what's fundamentally leading us to autocracy.
Well, Matt Stoller, you've given us an awful lot to think about. I'm very, very grateful for this conversation because I think you've both informed me and I think inspired our audience. And I thank you.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Matt Stoller, who until recently was a fellow at the Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation, where he researched the history of the relationship between concentrated financial power and the Democratic Party in the 20th century, and previously spent 6 years on Capitol Hill, most recently as a senior policy advisor to the Senate Budget Committee, where he focused on trade, competition policy, and financial services. And in addition to his work on the Hill, he's produced for MSNBC and starred in an FX political comedy show with Russell. Russell Brand. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the role of African-American women in the victory against Roy Moore in Alabama. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and the graduate chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She's the author of Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, which chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. Her latest book is From Palin to Trump, Evangelicals, Politics, and Race, and she joins us from the new Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthea Butler.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Well, thanks, Anthea, and it's good to talk to you again. And I was interested in getting your take on what happened down in Alabama and the role of African-American women in particular. I think they 90-something percent voted. I think they also got out the male vote as well, you know, and it was an interesting and obviously a very joyful thing that the good guy won down there and the bad guy lost. But it was also extraordinary contrast that you have religious women on the African-American side voting for the good guy and religious white women on the Roy Moore side voting for a child molester. So it was, the whole thing was pretty extraordinary.
Yes, it was. Well, I mean, it's hard. I think, you know, probably, and one level, it's easy to understand. African-American female voters got really motivated and were ready to get out there and vote for someone who basically said everything after the 10th Amendment we really didn't need, right? So basically, he's like, let's go back to slavery. Let's go back to the time that women can't vote. But I think what's really important about this is that there's two ways to look at this. One is that obviously the African-American vote got really mobilized. But the second is that white evangelical women are probably some of the most dangerous women to their own lives on earth, because basically they voted for the guy who would have molested their daughters at the mall. And so this is where we have to start to think about how they are voting for race over everything else. And I think it is a misnomer the ways in which, you know, a lot of this media has gone post-2016 election cycle that it was about, you know, feeling disenfranchised or jobs or all of this stuff. This is all racial. And we really need to start to see that. And it's race with regards to religion as well.
But how then? I mean, I think in many ways you always get back to the conversation about how do you revive the religious left in order to, you know, combat the religious right. And when you look at history, it was a lot of the white religious folks who ended slavery and marched in the civil rights marches in Selma, etc. So is that what needs to be done? That constituency needs to be revitalized?
Well, I think that's part of it. I think the other part of it is that, you know, what has happened, especially with the media, it's been easy to just look at evangelicals as this monolithic block of white evangelicals. But you have African-Americans, and especially a lot of African-American women who are Bible believers, right, who may or may not be for, you know, pro-life, but have conservative kinds of ideals that actually vote Democrat instead of Republican. And so I think a lot of people are hung up on the sort of, you know, what are white evangelicals doing, and they've forgotten what about what is the rest, what are the rest of Christians doing, whether that's, you know, liberal, liberal left-leaning Christians or, you know, sort of middle-of-the-road Christians, right? I don't think a lot of them really would have been for Roy Moore. They would have been appalled. So I think this is something that we have to really try to parse out better in the 2018 election cycle, because I think this is going to be the separation of, to use a term, for the wheat from the tares, basically. I think we're going to see this divide become a lot sharper, and I think we will see a resurgence of that religious left that you talk about.
Well, you can't help feeling, though, that we're all afflicted by this enormous challenge in America to find out whether we can reestablish a consensus over what is true and what is real. You've got Fox News, Breitbart, Sinclair creating this bubble in which the Roy Moore people live and which Trump supporters live. And now we're learning it's gone completely Orwellian, that the Trump administration's now issued guidelines for the Center for Disease Control where they can't use words like science. They can't use words like science-based and evidence-based. This is really migrating into a very dangerous Orwellian world.
Yeah, well, I think Orwellian is a good word. I would use also the word theocratic, and that means that a lot of this is based in these kinds of, again, very conservative religious beliefs. And I think that part of what is happening is that these are things that are being done to placate the right-wingers, right, to make them feel as though this theocracy that they would really like to have is coming into being. And this is a dangerous place. And I think that we have to, this is a moment in which we're going to have to decide how to push back against that, first of all, if the people are so inclined. And second of all, to realize that these, you know, these little erosions every day will create a kind of America that we don't want, first of all. And secondarily, that's not what the framers wanted.
Well, but do you take heart, I mean, or should we take heart from the fact that Trump's got, he's down to 32% now. So does that mean that there's 67% or 68% of Americans that we can work with that aren't, you know, in this bubble of theocratic right-wing delusion?
Yeah, I think we should take heart, but I don't think it's over yet. This is a man who thrives on being disliked in a way. He wants to be liked desperately, but he also thrives on being disliked, and so because he thinks it means that he's powerful. So I think actually now we're entering into a much more dangerous phase about this.
Well, I think my sense is, and I've heard this from sources in Washington, that as early as Friday, he's going to fire Mueller and shut down the investigation.
And I think that's a very big possibility. But I do think there's two things that will happen. One is you're going to see people in the street. And then second of all, you're going to see that this is going to be a big backlash against him because it doesn't matter. Nixon did a Saturday night massacre, and he still had to resign. I don't think that this is going to switch up anything about what's happening. And I think that he's still in the same amount of trouble. What I am afraid of is that these, you know, people, the 32% that still like him, are all militarized with guns, and that's a problem. So that's something we have to watch out for, that the tighter this problem becomes, it will get to be a little more dangerous for this country, I think. I think we'll get over it, but with Fox News right now talking about coups, which is a ridiculous word to use right now, I don't, you know, anything could happen, let's put it like that.
Right, but what if this happens, that he uses the Christmas break to fire Mueller, that this is a part of a coup. It's not the kind of made-up coup that Fox is talking about. This is a real coup. And what's at the heart of this is that the President of the United States is a traitor. And the Republican Party, either they know it or they don't, but they can't face the idea that their leader is a traitor, so they're going to try and cover it up along with him. If he were innocent, he would have from day one said, you know, to reestablish the authenticity of his victory and to get rid of any sense that he doesn't have the legitimacy that the voters gave him. He would have been the first person to want to clear the air about Russia. But no.
Oh, exactly.
There's something sick going on here. So my sense is that the only thing that makes any sense is that the guy's a traitor, and the Republicans can't deal with the backlash of that revelation, so they're trying to cover it up. But is there any way that you could get to those people with guns? Because they don't like traitors. The people with guns don't like traitors.
No, they don't. And I think it will take something, you know, to be honest with you, I think it will take something spectacular to get this going. So it's going to be an issue about whether or not, you know, those people with the guns will actually realize that he is a traitor and that there has been collusion. They will have to come to something really drastic will have to happen for that to occur.
So back to the role of African-American women, is there, how do you see, the guest on today's program prior to you is actually optimistic. He feels that it won't be so much of that the pendulum is going to swing back in the Democrats' favor, that he believes that the country is ripe for a kind of antitrust movement to go back to Teddy Roosevelt, that they know that the corporate takeover, the Cokes takeover of America is screwing them. They know from the tax bill that they're getting screwed. And all it takes is for new political leadership in the Democratic Party to articulate what the majority of Americans feel at the moment. Do you share that belief?
Well, I think, let me put it this way. I think that we're at a moment where things could really turn. And the problem that I'm having right now with Americans, quite frankly, is that I'm thinking back to, you know, what happened with South Korea's president and how millions of Koreans were out in the street all the time pushing back, pushing back, pushing back. We're not doing that. And so I'm just wondering about the level of there's angst and at the same time there's apathy, right? And I'm wondering when that level of apathy and angst is going to move into a level of activism, of real activism, and not just the spotty spots of activism, you know, whether that was the inauguration with the march and all that, that was great, but it's not enough, right? It's not enough to keep pushing back against what's going on right now.
Well, just in closing, though, the day after the inauguration, of course, millions of women showed up in across America and around the world in protest. What you're suggesting is those women have to come back, but they got to protest, you know, 24/7.
They have to come back. Yeah, they have to come back. They have to come back with men. Everything needs to shut down. Everything. Until he's out. If we're going to do this, if we're going to push back the tide of fascism, we're going to push back the tide of the things that are happening with ICE, the kinds of things that are happening right now and many communities across the country where people are being picked up and detained. And if we're going to push back against, you know, words being exalted from the CDC, if we're going to push back against the tax bill that is not designed to help anyone except the 1% of the 1%, then we're going to need to do something drastic. And that means getting out into the streets and staying there until change occurs.
Well, Anthea Butler, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Yeah, thank you, Ian.
And I've been speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania and author of Women in the Church of God in Christ, Making a Sanctified World, which chronicles the history of African-American women's religious lives and civic engagement in the Church of God in Christ, the largest Pentecostal denomination in the United States. Her latest book is From Palin to Trump, Evangelicals, Politics, and Race, and she joined us from the New Museum of the Bible in Washington, D.C. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.